Hi, my name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Lindsay Godwin, Director of Education and Training at Planned Parenthood of Middle and East Tennessee. Lindsay works with local schools, community groups, and faith communities on sexuality education, parent training, reproductive justice, and more. She has a master's degree in divinity from Vanderbilt University, where she focused on the religious ethics of sex, gender, and sexuality. And Lindsay is also one of the leaders of the Faith Team's 2012 Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute here at CAP. So welcome, Lindsay. I'm so glad you're with us today.
Thank you. I'm excited about the interview.
So I'd like to start right off by asking about a bill that's put Tennessee in the headlines, and it's a sex ed bill that recently passed in your state, and it's gotten a lot of national attention because of its radical nature. It's an abstinence-only bill that requires that sex ed curriculums discourage students from, and here I'm quoting, gateway sexual activity, whatever that is, and requires that students be taught the consequences of non-marital sexual activity. Can you tell us what's going on here, how the bill got passed, and what's behind it?
I can try. Some of it is in the same way that gateway sexual activity is sort of ambivalent. Some of how this has happened is a little ambivalent. But what we know, and we know this nationally as well, is that issues around reproductive justice, issues that have anything to do with Planned Parenthood, issues that have anything to do with sex or sexuality or gender have been hot-button issues politically, both here in Tennessee and across the nation. And so this bill has been a way of sort of flexing some political muscle for a number of our legislators. It's been a particularly issue-driven legislative season for Tennessee. So this is a piece of that broader puzzle. Some of the history behind why it was brought ties to two instances, one in a Knoxville City School and one in a Nashville City School, where parents weren't satisfied or had issues with some of the curriculum and some of the things that were happening in classrooms and brought those issues up. Those issues were then picked up by a local organization called the Eagle Forum and some other local conservative faith-based groups who took those issues and ran with them and created some legislation that they then were able to find legislators who supported it. Interestingly enough, when we've had some conversations with the legislators who supported this and put these bills out, when you ask them about what gateway sexual activity means or why it's important to not talk about anything in terms of sexual health, one of the things that they keep coming back to is that having any conversations about sexuality at all are like, the metaphor that they keep coming back to is that having any sexuality conversations is like starting a fire, a leaf fire in your yard, and once it gets going, you can't stop it.
Okay, then. Okay.
Right.
Is it your sense that the bill and those views of the legislators represent the average person in Tennessee, or do you think, which we know in some areas it's a pretty conservative Bible Belt state, or do you think it's even radical for a conservative state?
The experiences that I have in working with schools and working with educators and working with teens tell me that this has no actual bearing in terms of what most people want and need. We know that nearly 90% of adults in the South support a broad sense of comprehensive sexuality education in schools that includes conversations about abstinence, but also helps equip teens with knowledge to protect themselves, knowledge to have healthy relationships. We also know that in Tennessee specifically, that by their senior years, about 68% of teens will have had sex. So a bill that absolutely denies that and actually mandates that teachers cannot discuss sexual activity or equip their students with skills and information around protecting themselves with sexual activity does not match reality.
So you, let's talk a little bit about sexuality education, because you are a sexuality educator working in Tennessee. So what is the message that you bring? What is the values message you bring for people of faith who want to raise their kids in a moral way, but also want to keep their kids safe? What's a healthy way to talk about sex?
I think that it depends on what a person's values are, and that's part of where we come from, that we want each family, each person to identify and clarify their own values so that they can make decisions that match those. So that could mean any number of faith beliefs. That could mean any number of decisions. But that also does mean parents talking to their kids, their guardians and families and communities and faith communities talking about sex. And that's part of what I really would love to see more of, is continually having more conversations about sexuality and faith and how those things intersect and inform one another. So that's when, as an educator, as a Planned Parenthood educator, one of my first goals is to help people clarify their own values so that they can make decisions from that. But in terms of, you know, faith community having conversations or a parent having conversations, we know in terms of comprehensive sex ed that telling folks that abstinence is the best option and helping people figure out how to do that, while also saying, if you choose to have sex, here's how you protect yourself. We know that those things can go hand in hand, and together they can delay sexual activity, and they can help people have safer interactions when they do choose to have sex. So parents get a little freaked out because they think they may be giving mixed messages, but giving all of that information helps a young person make a good informed decision.
And what you have on your side is research and facts that actually shows kids, are safer and delay sexual activity. Sometimes, though, facts aren't that persuasive when they bump up against a value system. When you're talking to parents, when you're talking to educators, are those facts persuasive?
They can be sometimes. I think what's more persuasive is encouraging parents to be askable, and encouraging and giving parents tools to start conversations. And I think what happens for a lot of folks when it comes to any issue where we're talking about a developing teen and we're talking about something that may be controversial, so drugs, alcohol, even something like driving or dating or sex, oftentimes, what happens is we tell, and we don't listen or ask or start a conversation. And what developing young people really need are people to have conversations with. And so for us, when we're working with parents and when we're working with faith communities, what we really want to do is encourage folks to listen more, to have more conversations, and to put those facts in context with values. I fully support a parent saying, I want you to wait until marriage, because I get that why that decision is, I know why that decision is healthy, and I fully support that decision because it is the best way to prevent an unplanned pregnancy, to prevent a sexually transmitted infection. But that has to be coupled with, I trust you to make this decision for yourself, and here's the other information that may help you make that decision for yourself. We are in the business of equipping teens, everyone, all of us, all of our communities, our families, we're in the business, or we take on the responsibility of equipping teens to become fully functional, healthy adults. But we don't do that well when it comes to sex and sexuality.
Yeah.
And that's where the misstep is that we aren't listening, we aren't having conversations. We're just saying, don't have sex, or we're not talking about it.
Right. So here you are, a person of faith, and you have just said that you fully support parents saying to their kids, you know, I want you to wait until you get married before you have sex, and you can understand why that would be something, why that might be a good decision. So there's that. And then you work for Planned Parenthood, which you know, has, among conservatives at least, a very diabolical reputation. And in the early part of this year, in fact, it sounds like your Planned Parenthood was quite threatened with being with losing your federal funding and partnerships that you had had with local public TV stations and other agencies were nearly canceled. So what was going on there, and what was that discrepancy between, you know, the values and faith-based work you do, actually do, and then the perception?
I think that's an ongoing struggle for Planned Parenthood, but also for any person or any organization who's trying to talk honestly and openly about sexuality and gender issues and talking about it in terms of faith. For all of the things that have happened this spring around Planned Parenthood, around reproductive health, there's been this continual sort of, and I will say politicized, push to say, to sort of narrowly define what Planned Parenthood does, that we are about abortions and making people have sex or encouraging people to have sex. Those aren't necessarily the things that we're actually focused on. We work really hard every day to prevent unplanned pregnancies, and we work to help people clarify their own values. So what happened for us were some political things that people were trying to push upon us. And it's hard because having the in-depth faith conversation actually requires sitting down and listening, sitting down and having conversation, and not just speaking in sort of broad strokes. I started off track.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No. So when those threats came to your Planned Parenthood, do you have community support?
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of community support. In terms of partnerships that we have, in terms of individuals, in terms of faith communities. One instance, we actually worked very closely with Nashville Public Television this fall to film the last portion of their Children's Health Crisis series. And that series was, the last part of that series is focused on sexuality. They came to us because we are experts in providing sexuality education and working with youth around these topics. And what happened with all of that is that we were actually going to partner with Rocket Town, which is a faith-based youth service organization. And we had a lot of conversations up front with Rocket Town, with Nashville Public Television, to say, this is what we're doing. We're part of this partnership. We would love to have our kickoff event here. And at the last minute, sort of in the 11th hour, there was a little bit of pushback from some of the folks from Tennessee Right to Life and some of the folks who we'd not been in direct contact with, some of the higher-ups within the organization, decided that they weren't able to continue to partner with us because of that perception. I think what we struggle with is getting past that perception, mm-hmm. and again, that's about those conversations.
Mm-hmm. So. When you talk with faith communities, parents, and students about faith and sexuality, what are some attitudes that you come across? And how rare or common is it for parents to talk with their kids about these issues?
I think that we assume that people don't want to have the conversation. And I think people want to have the conversations. I think people want to talk about sex. They're young folks. I think people want to talk about sex more in their faith communities. And it's been so stigmatized that we don't know how. And that's what I run into most when I'm talking to folks of faith, is that somehow we want to talk about sexual decision-making, or we want to talk about healthy relationships, or we want to talk, make sure that our teens are equipped with information. We just don't know how, and we don't know how to cross that line, and it's uncomfortable for a lot of folks, and it's awkward. And so that's what I continually encounter. That I get that more often than this is inappropriate or we can't mm-hmm. talk about that.
Well,
in a real-life situation.
Right. And I would think people would be really hungry for it, teens and I guess maybe parents too, because, you know, for kids to really navigate their lives – if on the one hand they kind of have Jersey Shore and, you know, TV throwing these messages at them of hookups and one night stands and things that just really go counter to their value system, and then that's one extreme. And if on the other extreme they've got people saying, just say no, don't talk about it, don't do this, that isn't very realistic either. What are the guideposts, and how do they live according to their values but still be a human being and not see sex as a negative or a bad thing? So parents and groups like yourself and churches have a huge role to play.
And I think what we could do better, at least a place to start, would be to talk about respect as a value and an ethic. Respect for oneself and respect for one's relationship with the sacred and respect for any partner or person that you may be in relationship with and how we build that respect and act that respect out. It's interesting because I encounter a lot of adults who don't think teens know what they're doing, know what they're talking about, don't trust teens, that sort of thing. But every time I'm in a classroom, I have teens who are able to give me thoughtful analyses of what a healthy relationship looks like, of what they really want for themselves. But they're continually not given space to actually name those things or say them. And we have to learn to listen, and we have to learn to trust them. One of the comparisons that I've heard around sex ed and sort of avoiding talking about it or abstinence only is comparing it to teaching somebody to drive a car. This is what we're doing with youth. We are ideally equipping them to be adults. So if we took teaching how to drive a car and applied abstinence only education to it, it would mean driving a car can be scary, and you might die, and the only way to protect yourself is to not drive.
The end.
The end.
That, the end of driver ed. The end.
Right. That's what driver's ed would look like if we applied abstinence-only education to it.
It will kill you.
Right. So to apply that to our sexual lives, we are all sexual beings. We are all born as sexual beings. I also believe we're all born as sacred beings. To apply that sort of approach to something that is crucial in our lives. We all have attractions. We have, we get excited. We have relationships. Even for somebody who, you know, somebody who is taking a vow against that because they identify as a nun or what have you, they're still living in a sexual world. So for us to not talk about those aspects of our humanity in ways that are constructive and help us navigate that is doing us all a disservice. And it keeps us from having healthy relationships.
Yeah. I really like what you say about sacred and sexuality, because you rarely hear those two words in the same sentence. And it's true, but it's not something you often hear. I just want to ask you a question about your teaching in the schools. So are you in the public schools? Does a Planned Parenthood have contracts? And what will this new law mean for the kinds of sex ed that you've been teaching?
So I can speak for Planned Parenthood of Middle and East Tennessee. Each Planned Parenthood affiliate is different. For our Nashville office, we actually are an approved resource for the Metro Nashville Public Schools and have been a longtime partner with the Nashville Public Schools. There are a number of teachers in the district who call on us to help either add to what they're doing in the classroom and supplement, or sometimes to help actually do a good amount of that sexuality education that they're required to do by law, because we are experts at it, because it's what we do. And we've actually developed a curriculum called Promoting Healthy Decisions, where we've use abstinence as the sort of the centerpiece, but talk about anatomy, pregnancy, birth control, sexually transmitted infections, and then talk about decision making and communication and refusal skills throughout those topics. So that's what we do when we're in the schools. We also do professional training. We have, you know, work with parents. We work with other community partners. In terms of this bill, because in having those conversations, we're following evidence-based and evidence-informed curriculum that require talking about behaviors like a person using their hands to give a partner pleasure and other such quote-unquote gateway sexual activities. It's questionable as to what, if anything, we'll be able to do in school. And that means that there are a number of teachers who have relied on us for decades that we won't be able to partner with any longer.
When does the bill take effect? When
is the governor has not signed it yet, so we have both, the House and the Senate have both passed it. We do not have any word from the governor yet, so there's a possibility of a veto still. Mm-hmm. We're not sure, but it would take effect for the next school year.
And would it be challenged in the courts? Is anybody?
That's a good question, and I have not heard any conversation mm-hmm. about that yet. I don't know how they would be able
that
to
anybody
do that
would.
For this specific thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd like to go back to Planned Parenthood for a minute, which is not a faith-based organization. It's a health provider and works with women. But you sort of have a faith outreach job there that's connected to your sexuality education work. And can you talk for a minute about why you think it's important for groups like Planned Parenthood to partner with faith organizations and faith communities in the work that they do?
Absolutely. Part of it for me personally goes back to the idea that we are all sacred, created in the image of God, and sexual beings. But those are intrinsic parts of what it means to be human. So just on that in and of itself, it's important for Planned Parenthood to recognize and work with faith organizations and faith groups and communities and vice versa. But also our staff are folks of faith oftentimes. Our clients are oftentimes folks of faith. People don't leave their morals and their values and their faith outside when they come to get birth control or when they come into sexuality education training. And so it's crucial that we continue to bridge those gaps and talk about what it means to be human, what it means to be a sexual being, what it means to be a beloved child of God. And so that's why I think it's crucial to continue to build those relationships and build up that work. Also, the work that we do is about justice, is about community justice, is about challenging systems of oppression, is about allowing an individual the right and dignity to make their own decisions and protect their own health and protect the health of their family, the health of their families and their partners. And those are all moral and ethical sacred questions as well. And so all of those things continue to necessitate partnerships between faith communities and Planned Parenthood.
What's it like working with faith leaders? So if people of faith access your services and find resonance in the way you talk about women's health care and human sexuality, that's really important. Then we also have institutions, religious institutions, churches, mm-hmm. houses of worship, and clergy. And I know that when you were at Vanderbilt, you did some focus groups with local faith leaders on sexuality issues. What did you learn from them in terms of how comfortable are they in addressing these issues, and where are they sort of along the political spectrum?
Well, in the same way that there is a wide, wide range of what it means to be faithful, there's a wide, wide range of what folks are comfortable with and where they are. But in the focus group specifically, the one message that was incredibly clear is that clergy and faith leaders are desperate for spaces to talk about the intersection of faith and sexuality. So that may mean things like we've been talking about, things like sex ed, or talking about abortion, but it also means spaces to safely talk about healthy relationships or to talk about unhealthy relationships and abuse, safe spaces to talk about gender identity or sexual orientation or what to do when a congregant comes out to you. Safe spaces to talk about marriage and what the expectations are and the sexual things within that. Safe spaces even to talk about interpersonal relationships with other clergy, and or when someone is being harassed or being treated in a certain way because of their gender. And we don't talk about those things well in terms of faith. But those are, again, things that each human being comes encounter with.
And do you think that, so there's a hunger to talk about that, there's a need, a recognition by clergy that, that there's a need for that. What do they need? Do they need skills and content in order to be more ready to have those conversations?
I think the first thing, at least, that the clergy folks that I spoke with needed was safe space to name mm-hmm. that these things are even questions and concerns. Before they could even get to skills and words and language, they needed safe space to say, okay, I can talk about the fact that my congregant just hit on me, or that, you know, this teen just came to me with this question that I don't know what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually a starting place, which sounds maybe overly simplistic, but I think is really honest.
Yeah.
And also the space to say it is okay to talk about being a sexual being as part of being a human being and also as part of being a faithful
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that, and then there's a whole other level of needing for there to be more community conversation, more national conversation, and more folks who are saying, I'm a person of faith, and I claim something different from what a loud voice in the conservative movement says.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And then there are skills and tools and curriculum and all, you know, prayers and those sorts of things that people also need.
Right. You talked earlier about being involved in justice work, and sexuality education is a part of justice work. And the Faith Institute that you're part of here at CAP, we're calling it the Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute. How do you define and talk about reproductive justice? What? How does that term come to life for you?
That is a huge question.
There's no right or wrong answers.
I know that for me it is a piece of a system. So reproductive justice is a lens and a way that I look at systematic injustice that also includes race and class and gender and ethnicity and faith and all sorts of other things. But for me, my entry point is looking at each person, recognizing the sacred within each person, and allowing them the space and the dignity and the access to make healthy choices for themselves, whether that means they come out as gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender or queer or a gender identity that doesn't fit the normative pattern. Whether it means they are a teen who's trying to figure out how to navigate pressure from their partner, whether it means there's a woman who needs to make a decision about a pregnancy and needs to make a choice. All of those pieces are intersecting realities that at the core, at the base, need a recognition of dignity and the sacredness of each person to make the decisions and to honor their own relationship with the sacred. And for me, justice is creating the space, creating the communities, and creating the systems that honor that for each person.
Mm-hmm. So just a last question for you. So these kind of discouraging things have been happening with the sexuality education radical abstinence-only bill, and then Planned Parenthood's had some rough times, gone through rough waters. What's your outlook these days? Does it feel like you really are pushing a rock up a steep hill? Are there things that give you hope that you think, oh, here's a little breeze at our back? Things aren't completely against us. What's your sense of your local landscape that you're working in?
I have three answers to this question. One answer, and sort of at the most basic level, the thing that gives me hope are the day-to-day interactions that I have,
mm-hmm.
Whether it is with a community partner, or just a casual conversation where somebody says, thank you for doing this work or taking that stand. More often, it's when I'm working with youth,
mm-hmm.
or working with somebody that we're educating, and they say something like, oh, now this makes sense, or I didn't know that, and I'm, you know, that totally just changed my mind, mm-hmm. or totally changed the way I am looking at this. Those are the things that give me hope, because it's sort of those again, going back to that relationality and the dignity of each person, and making sure that part of that dignity is their ability to have information to make good decisions. In terms of the broader political culture of Tennessee right now, it's likely to feel like this for a while. And I still do this work because I know that it is what I'm called to do, and it is work that needs to be done. In some ways, this becomes a new normal.
Yeah, you're right.
And the metaphor I've been using a lot lately is that in some ways it's similar to the stages of grief a person goes mm-hmm. through when they've lost someone.
Mm-hmm.
There's anger, and there's denial, and there's bargaining, and there are all these things that you sort of go through as you're trying to figure out how you hold your ground and stand your place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you hit a sense of, okay, this is my new normal, this is what I'm working in, and I will continue to do this work on a one-on-one basis and a community basis, and continue to build conversations, build relationships, and try to create space where people are listening to each other, where people at their heart see the other person, even if it's somebody who they totally disagree with, as another child of God, as another sacred being, and are able to start there.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of starting at places of anger and hatred and grossness.
Mm-hmm.
So I hold on to that.
Are those two? Those are like the glasses half empty, the glasses half full. Or it's really persevering. It's carrying on when things really, really don't go your way.
Yeah. And it is a continual conversation. And I think that's the third piece for me. I hold on to Martin Luther King Jr.'s and any number of other folks who also hold on to this and hold this up, the idea that the arc of our lives, of humanity, all of it bends toward justice, and we work toward a beloved community of grace, and that this is all part of that. It means it's not pretty sometimes, and it's frustrating and tiring, but it is also what it means to be in community and what it means to be here and human and try to figure out what it means to be loving.
And we each do our part, and that's what you're doing. You're doing your part every day. So thank you so much, Lindsay, for being with us, and thank you for your good work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I hope that it was helpful.
It was. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.